Golf Smarter, number 607, is brought to you by MyBookie.ag, who invites you to watch your favorite games and start making money. And our opening theme is brought to you by Joe Beyer. Hit it, Joey! Short game fixes, tricks, and keys to lower scores from around the green with Josh Zander.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Josh.
Thank you, Fred. It's good to be with you.
It's great to be with you. It was great to meet you last week, and I can't wait to share it with our audience next week. You did a short game clinic for a charity tournament that I played at, and I was lucky enough to stick a microphone on your lapel just before you started the clinic, and we got the whole thing. So we're gonna play that audio next week because it was really valuable. But at the end of the evening, after the clinic and a round of golf and dinner, I got up in front of the crowd and asked everybody there, "How'd you like Josh's clinic today?" And everyone raised their hand. And I said, "How many of you remember what he said about short game, about chipping?" And they all kind of like, I said, "Exactly." It was completely overwhelming. He had so much great information that we recorded it and we're going to use it in a podcast. So please check it out. And they were like, "Thank you. Thank you." Because just even getting a lesson can be overwhelming with the amount of information you get. So a clinic like that, for guys who've been playing for so long.
There's a lot of information. There's no doubt there's a lot of information. And I know that the way I learn best is I go through it and then I take notes. And then if I can rewatch it or re-listen to it, even better, and I can kind of learn at my own pace. So I totally understand. We covered a lot in a short amount of time. But there should be some useful things that'll get those guys to play some better golf.
Yeah. No, there were very useful things, but what was so fun, I got to tell you, I got to be completely honest with you, the best line of the day during our round of golf was, "I hate Josh Zander!"
It's not the first time I've heard that one.
And that's because everybody in my foursome was trying to use some of the tips that you provided with us without ever having practiced them, and nobody can get them to work. It's like, well, of course you can't. You didn't practice, and you're not exactly sure what he was saying. So that's why I'm really glad we recorded it.
You got to have clarity. You got to be able to practice it in order to be able to put it into play. I actually, I know you want to ask me some questions, but I had a clinic the other day with some juniors, and I went over some of the short game concepts, and they all started chipping with their lob wedges, and I got them to learn how to putt from the fringe and chip with their hybrids and chip and run with some lower lofted clubs. And then we had a little competition at the end after about 40 minutes of working on it. I said, "Okay, we're going to divide up into teams. There's going to be push-ups on the line for the losing team, and here we go. We're chipping to this hole." And they all went back and got their lob wedges. And a few years ago, I would have said, "You know, what are you guys thinking?" But as I learned more about the performance part of golf, they were going to what they felt comfortable with. So if your gut isn't confirming what your head is saying, then you shouldn't go with that new skill because you don't own it yet. So I actually said, "You know what? Good for you guys for going to what you know how to do well. And after you practice the new stuff, you'll be able to put it into play. But it's not until you feel comfortable in a practice situation that you should be even thinking about putting that into play on the golf course or in a tournament."
It blows my mind how often people will do attempt to make shots that they've never practiced, but they saw it once on TV.
There you go.
It's amazing.
Not a good formula.
Not a good formula. Yeah. It's amazing. What do you mean the performance part of golf?
Well, the performance part of golf is what I call being able to access your skill set. So you may be able to do something in practice. You may be able to perform it on the range, and then being able to access that. So you have that skill. In order to be able to perform that skill, you need to be in the proper mental state. And part of being in the proper mental state is having the confidence that you can pull it off under pressure. And that means that your brain may be saying something, but your heart and your gut needs to be coherent with what your brain is saying. And if not, doubt enters. And when doubt enters, all bets are off. You're not going to have access to your skills at that point.
Absolutely. And we've even had conversations the last couple of weeks about how difficult it is to take your A game that shows up on the range over to the first tee. And I think that it's consistent with what you're saying in the sense that people aren't confident in what they're doing and they try to do stuff that they don't feel comfortable with, but they think they can do it. And what ends up happening is when you stand over the ball, this is my impression, when you stand over the ball, all this tension gets introduced to your hands, your body, your shoulders, your breathing, your neck, everything, and makes it difficult when you just can't and you can't perform.
Exactly. And it doesn't mean that you don't have that skill. It means that you're not in a mental state to be able to perform that skill. Or if you, it may be that you don't have that skill, in which case you're crazy to think you're going to be able to pull it off, mm-hmm. you know, when you're under the gun. But even if you have a skill, you need to be able to put yourself in the proper mental state and thinking about how to do it, what we call being, you know, in the language center of your brain, very left brain during playing golf, is a formula for disaster. And that's why a lot of people can't take their games from the range to the course, is because they're still giving themselves instructions on how to make the swing, rather than just getting more sensory, more feel based, more visual, more auditory in more of a performance, in a performance way of doing things. And the best example I like to give people is, if you're running down a set of stairs, how are you actually doing that? Are you thinking about what your knees and your feet and your legs are doing to run down a set of stairs? I mean, a flight of stairs, you're going to fall if you actually are thinking about that, but that's how we like to play golf. We're giving ourselves instructions mechanically on how to do something while we're doing it, and that's a recipe for failure. And if it wasn't a recipe for failure, I'd recommend it. But that's how most people play their golf. It's, you know, another example would be if you thought about how you drive, what you're actually doing to make a left-hand turn with, you know, oncoming traffic. I mean, you're not thinking about how you're turning the wheel. You're just reacting to what's in front of you. And part of the challenge of golf is that we have all this time to think about it. Mm-hmm. And we're not reacting. We're not interacting with the target. We're very, very language center of the brain focused, and we're giving ourselves instructions. And the swing's over in a second and a half. It's just not... there's just not enough time to do that and be successful. So as long as people if they think that's how they're going to perform, they're not really ever going to reach their potential or be able to access whatever skills they do currently have.
Mm-hmm. No question about it. Let's back up a little bit about you. Tell us your golf history.
Well, I grew up overseas in Caracas, Venezuela. Really? I was born and raised there. I was the national junior champion of Venezuela at several different age groups, and came up to the States for boarding school in Connecticut, played my high school golf there, and then came out to Stanford and played on the golf team there. And after Stanford, played for 3 years on different tours throughout the world, played in South America, played in Asia, and played in my son just walked into my office.
Hi.
With a big thing of ice cream. Offer me a lick. That's such a nice guy.
Here's why you're going to love podcasts.
Daughter waving at me too. Yeah, right in the middle of the podcast. Perfect.
Yeah, and this is why you're going to love podcasts, because we're not going to go, what is that kid doing in the room? We're trying to shoot a TV show here.
That's perfect. Well, that's life, you know. Everybody out there has a life, and there's more than just sit in your office getting work done. So
that's not true. That's not true. Golfers, that's all they do. That's their entire lives. Whether they're teaching, they're playing on the tour, or they're playing for fun, that's
exactly
all they do. It's just golf.
Sometimes we forget that those guys playing golf on weekends on TV, they actually have lives that affect their play. So getting back to my background, so after playing college golf at Stanford, played around the world for a few years. Highlight of my playing career was playing in the U.S. Open in 1992, which I actually qualified at Lake Merced in Northern California here, and then went and played at Pebble Beach and enjoyed that. That was a fantastic experience. Mm. Played for another year after that, and then decided that being living out of a suitcase and traveling all over the world was fun in my early 20s, but I could kind of see the writing on the wall that the best I would probably be would be a journeyman on the tour. And I thought, you know, is that really how I want to spend my time? I don't think I'd have a 6 and 8 year old walking into my office with ice cream all over their face. And that's part of what makes me happy. So I'd probably be still out there chasing that ball. And it's not really where my passion was for how I wanted to build a career. So I got into teaching. My first teaching job was working for Hank Haney. He had a small construction business in Marin at McInnes Park, the little 9-hole executive course up there.
That's where I started playing golf.
That's where I got my
start. That's where I started playing golf, too. That's crazy.
There you go. So that was my first job. That was, I believe, 1994, my first teaching job. And then worked there for a couple of years, got hired by Golf Digest to run a learning center for them back east in New Jersey. And I've been writing for Golf Digest since then, since 1997. So going to 20 years doing stuff with them. And then I came back to Northern California in 1999, I believe it was, and started teaching at the Presidio and, starting in 2000, started teaching at Stanford. So currently I'm at Stanford and also teaching at, Sharon Heights in Menlo Park. So that's kind of, those are my two offices right now. And it's been great. Go ahead.
No. I was going to ask a little more about Stanford. Are you just doing individual lessons there, or are you team coach? How does it work for you at Stanford?
No, I'm not team coach. I have done some volunteering of my time for the women's team, particularly probably overall 7 or 8 years doing that through the years. Currently just, anybody wants to take a lesson. That's kind of where I hang my shingle and I'll teach anybody who wants to learn.
Whether they're a Stanford
to, touring pro,
whether they're Stanford employee, just people can come off the street to oh
yeah,
and it's, take a lesson.
You don't have
there.
To have any affiliation with Stanford. Yeah.
So absolutely. Let me ask you then: do you get access if you're taking lessons from you? Do you get access to the golf course?
Technically, no.
Okay, fine.
But I know people in high places who might be able to help out on occasion.
I've been lucky enough, because my older son went there, I've been lucky enough to play that course a couple times and would love to come back. I love that golf course. Yeah.
I think we can make that happen for you.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I wasn't asking. But when I'm not going to let you go with the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach in 92. Did you make the cut?
I did not. I made a rookie error. First day I'd shot 3 over and looked like it was going to be tough to make the cut. But then I was 2 under for the first 7 on the second day. So I was 1 over par. But I looked up at the leaderboard and Gil Morgan was going crazy. And he was the first player in the history of the U.S. Open to get to double digits under par. I looked at the scoreboard on it. I looked at my caddy and I said, oh my goodness, I got to get aggressive here to get within 10 shots of Gil to make the cut here. And I started being aggressive on, if you know Pebble Beach, on 8, 9, and 10.
Ooh.
Not a good move. Mm. Yeah. Turns out I didn't need to do that. I just need to finish in the top 60 to make the cut. But I went on to shoot, I think, a 40 on the back 9 and a 76 on the second day and missed it by 4 shots. But I did tie Jack Nicklaus. So I feel like the only tournament I ever played against Jack, I'm tied with him, so I figure that was pretty good.
That's very good. What was the rookie mistake?
Yeah. Well, the rookie mistake was getting aggressive when I didn't need to.
Mm-hmm.
I just go stick to my game plan. I mean, I had that course mapped out. I mean, that was, even though I was playing at a level that I wasn't used to playing at, I was still, very focused on just playing my game, and that kind of got me out of my game. And my dad and uncle were following me, and I hit a nice tee shot on 8, and then we had about a 20-25 minute wait. Second shot on 8, if you're familiar with that, Jack Nicklaus calls it the best second shot in golf.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting there above that chasm, hitting across it, and you got to wait during that time. And that's when I started looking at leaderboards, and it just sort of got me out of my rhythm, and went on to bogey the next few holes, and that kind of got me out of there. So. I thought to myself, well, next time that won't happen, but there never was a next time.
I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at you for that.
Which is just fine. It was a dream week. I got to play practice rounds with Tom Watson and Fred Couples. And my essay to get into Stanford was, if I could spend a day with anybody, who would it be and what would I do? And the answer was, I'd spend a day playing golf with Tom Watson at Pebble Beach. So my dream came true, and even better, it was a practice round for a major championship. So it was a dream week. I'll never forget it. And and life's still been pretty awesome, even though I haven't played another major.
Mm. So in that vein of getting too aggressive, was part of that because you were looking at the scorecard and that's what took you out of your game plan?
Yeah, I figured once Gil got to 10 under par and I was one over for the tournament at that point, I'm like, okay, I need to get make a couple birdies coming in here in the next, 10 or 11 holes. And I really didn't need to, because I think three over made the cut. And so if I would have gone two over for the next 11 holes, I would have made it, which I was clearly playing well enough to do that. So, that's just life.
Yeah.
It's totally fine.
That's golf. How do you feel about, let's now, we talk about amateur golf here, and that's really what the focus is talking about amateur golfers who are not playing tournament play, they're weekend hacks, and they're trying to find one or two tips and things. But the kind of tips that I look for are like this. Do you advocate looking at your scorecard during the round?
I don't. I actually think if I was the czar of golf and I had a chance to make any rule I could, I would eliminate score from amateur golf, especially non-tournament amateur golf.
I mean, really?
Thinking about your score ruins people's days. I mean, what are you really out there for as an amateur? I went out today and played San Francisco Golf Club with a few other pros, and we had such a good time. I had to leave early for a meeting, but I played 14 holes and I really could care less what my score was. Mm-hmm. I really could. And I played fine. I think I was one over for 14 holes. It was a beautiful day, 70 degree weather out with a bunch of great guys on a wonderful golf course. And I would have had fun if I shot eight over for 14 holes. It's about recreating. It's not about, my self-worth is based on what my number is or what my handicap is. I mean, what are you really out there for? I think one of the fun things about playing golf in England is, they have foursomes at some courses where you play with four people and you play two balls. It's like alternate shot. And played it at, can't remember which course it was, but we played your own ball in the morning and foursomes in the afternoon. And it was so much fun to play foursomes in the afternoon. You'd finish a hole, one guy would walk down the fairway, you'd walk to the tee, and you're playing like 2.5 hours and you're having fun. You have a couple beers at the end of the round or whatever your favorite beverage is. And you just have a good time because you're out there hitting the golf ball with your friends. And that's really what amateur golf is. Mm-hmm. I think won't name the teacher, but one teacher calls professional golf ego-based, whatever, and ego-based entertainment or something like that. It's like, what are you really out there for? If you go think about it, you should have a good time when you play golf, regardless of your score. And unfortunately, golf makes too many people miserable and frustrates you. But if it didn't matter, you'd play better and you wouldn't worry about your score. So I don't think score is really something that amateur golfers should worry about. It's part of the game. It's part of the culture that you keep your score. But once you figure this out, I'm going to have a good time regardless of how I play. Now you've won either way in my book.
Yeah. I talked to a caddy once. I had a caddy on the show, and he actually said, if you're having fun, then you're a good golfer.
Yeah. Well, that's what you're out there for.
Yeah. Yeah. He says, because no one ever claims to be a good golfer.
That's especially, being in the pro ranks for so long, as a touring professional, as a teaching professional, we all got into the game because we loved to hit the ball, because it was a lot of fun. We didn't get in there to judge ourselves by how we score. That's not what kids, that's what, when you first get into it, that's not what attracts a kid to the game. When you look at a 5-year-old on the range whacking a ball, they don't care that it went left or went right. They just can't wait to hit the next one.
Mm-hmm. Well, watching adults on the driving range, I get the sense that they just want to hit the ball over and over and over, whether they analyze what went wrong or not. Just keep hitting another one. Keep hitting another one.
And that may be what's fun for them. I'm not saying that that's not fun. I mean, to me, hitting balls by yourself on the range. It's a therapeutic kind of a zen like experience, and it's like a sort of meditation.
Uh-huh.
takes you away from the other things in your life that may be bugging you or stressing you out, and here's a chance to just you and the golf ball and the challenge of hitting it well and figuring that out. I think that's fun. When you start putting a score to it, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, what'd you shoot? So should you feel good about yourself when you shoot a 69 and bad about yourself when you shoot an 85? Is that what really measures you as a human being? And that's, unfortunately, we define ourselves a lot by how that, you know, what the score says. So to make a long story short, no, don't look at your scorecard. Don't worry about it. In fact, be the one who doesn't keep the score for the group if you can afford to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you got to be the scorekeeper, but anytime there's an option, I don't do it because I don't want to write down that number. The best rounds I've ever shot have been when I didn't know what my score was.
Wow.
I had a lead going into the only chance I ever had of winning a college golf tournament. I had a lead Olympic club with 9 holes to go. And going into the last day, I was probably 4 or 5 back, and I had a great front nine. I shot like 31 or something on the front nine on the lake course, and had the lead, and was told by the Washington coach that I had the lead, and I was like in protect mode, and I shot 39 or 40 on the back and finished like 7th or 8th. And if I wouldn't have known that, I would have just kept playing my, you know, hitting one shot at a time and enjoying the experience. And then I would have added up my score at the end and probably would have won the thing. But, and there are some players like Jack Nicklaus always like to know where he stood, but man, he was good enough to be able to see where he stood and then adjust his strategy accordingly, but not let it affect him.
Uh-huh.
It only helped him. So there are some players who can do that. That's not me. I would say most players don't have that kind of mental acumen to be able to put that aside and say, okay, well, I know I need to do this in order to win. I'm going to have to be, you know, more aggressive here, less aggressive there, whatever it is, based on what the other players are doing. But in golf, pretty much you can't really affect what anybody else does. All you can do is affect what you do. So at least in metal play golf,
it makes
match play might be a little bit different, but.
Yeah, it makes me crazy when, you know, people demand to play for money. It's like, okay, fine, we'll play for money. Just tell me what I owe you at the end. And they insist on giving you updates every hole or every other hole on where we stand on the match. And it's like, I don't care.
That's right.
Tell me at the end. I don't want to know these things. You're bugging me.
Yeah. So one of the best thing I ever heard about that was my advisor in boarding school happened to be the dean of students, and his best friend was the head of the school. And what they would do when they'd go out and they'd play, you know, they'd play with some heavy rollers who would, you know, be fun, you know, people who donated money to the school, and they'd want to play for a lot of money. And they said, no problem, play for as much as you want. And Lance will be on one team, Rusty will be on the other team. And so we'll pay each other at the end. So it didn't matter if they were playing for $1,000 or whatever, you know, makes you choke. They agreed that neither one of them would collect and they'd be on opposite teams. And there you had it.
Oh, that's funny.
So they figured it out.
That's very good. That's very good. Do you believe in bifurcation then? Do you think there should be a set of rules for tournament and tour play versus and another set of rules for everybody else?
I don't think that's a bad idea, actually. I haven't really put a lot of thought into it, but I think if you actually watch how amateur golf is played, it's not played by the rules anyway. Giving putts
absolutely
is not part of the
right.
Rules. That let's just start there, not to mention the million other ways that amateurs, you know, break the quote unquote rules of golf. So again, I'm like, this is your chance to go out and have a good time. And if you hit a ball out of bounds and forget to hit a provisional, are you going to walk back and, you know, stop up the golf course? You're going to drop one right there and just play and say, well, you can't take more than a 6 on this hole. So is that really what your score was? No. You might have made a 15 on that hole if you actually went back and then hit another one out of bounds. You know, I think that that's a very, very good question. And I think, you know, I haven't thought about it a lot, but just thinking about it here for a couple of minutes, I think that's absolutely how it should be.
Hmm.
so people can have fun.
Exactly.
So we don't have people miserable at the end of a round.
And to pick up the pace of play.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's an emphatic agreement.
I don't get to play a lot of golf. And if I have to wait when I'm playing golf, it drives me crazy.
Yep.
It absolutely drives me crazy.
Yep.
A five-hour round of golf would drive me crazy. Absolutely. I mean, more than four is already starting to drive me a little bit crazy. Hmm. That means you're just waiting. It's not. You lose your rhythm. It's just not a fun way to play. But there's a lot of that out there in public golf.
Yeah, I mean, like I would rather drive
5.5 hour rounds.
Yeah, I'd rather drive for an hour and a half at the speed limit and go 90 miles versus drive for an hour and a half in traffic and go 5 miles. You know, it's like,
right.
If I'm going to be in the car for an hour and a half, keep me moving, but don't make me wait. Crazy. Just drives me nuts. Thank you for all that information and for your history. Fascinating. Let's talk about this clinic that you did for us. And again, these were, you talked about doing the clinic with juniors and young people and what they do and how they absorb what you were teaching. But I was playing at a tournament with a bunch of, let's just say older gentlemen. All right. There were.
Yeah. Not juniors.
Not juniors. My foursome, had three guys in their 70s. So tell you there, right? So they don't necessarily hear what you're trying to teach them, but you gave a lot of phenomenal information. I'm just going to pick your brain for just a few minutes that we have left here about short game tricks and secrets of yours, and we can start with chipping. Okay. Start with chipping. And by the way, I want you to know, but also let everybody who's listening, that there's going to be a couple of videos that came out of that clinic. Let's just say there's going to be a video of you working with one person one-on-one on doing some pitching. And I thought it was great because you really gave some great information there. So that's going to be a short one that's going to be on our YouTube channel. But next week we'll get to hear the whole, the entire clinic that you gave, but let's talk about, start with, chipping. Any kind of tricks or secrets that you have?
Yeah. So I would say the first thing is entertain the option that you don't always take your sand wedge out when you chip, and not that you can't chip with your sand wedge, but the thing about using a sand wedge when you're chipping everything is on some longer chips, you're going to have to swing harder or bigger, and more things can go wrong the bigger and harder you swing. And one of the other things that happens when you make a bigger swing with a sand wedge is you put more spin on it. And a lot of people are infatuated with spin, but I find spin to be one more variable that I have to take into account to get my distance control right. So I would rather roll the ball along the green and not have it biting on the green in order to be able to calibrate distance better. And this was a lesson I learned when I was at Stanford, and Tom Watson came and gave us gave our team a chipping clinic. And first thing he said was, I can't control backspin, but I can control trajectory and roll. And that was, Watson in 1986, who was probably the second best short game player on tour at that point behind Seve Ballesteros. So I took that to heart and started chipping with different clubs. So when I'm teaching, I always say, hey, could you putt this ball? If you can't putt it, what's the least lofted club you can chip it with? And kind of work your way through your decision making that way, as opposed to, always taking out your sand or lob wedge. And I think a lot of the reasons why people take out their sand or lob wedge is they see that on TV and they say, well, if somebody's chipping, they always have their sand wedge out. Well, on TV, they're playing greens that are rolling. The slowest would be 11 on the stimp and sometimes 13 or 14 on the stimp, which are firm, fast greens. And so they can't chip with a 7 or 8 iron and things going to roll across the green. So they need a little bit of spin to stop the ball from rolling too much. But most of us don't play that kind of golf. We play on greens that are 8s and 9s and 10s, and we can chip with something a little bit lower. If you watch the British Open, you'll see a lot more of that because the greens are slower. And the greens are slower because the wind doesn't allow you to make the greens so fast. So the ball would be going off the greens with the gusts of wind. So you see a lot more 7, 8 iron chipping and sometimes hybrid chipping, like when Todd Hamilton beat Ernie Els at the British Open, that hybrid club that he was using a chip with won him the tournament. He hit some amazing chips with that. So I would say if that's maybe a conceptual thing or a strategy thing, to help you, with your short game. I think the other thing to understand is how to use the club correctly. Most of us are, because we're using too much loft, we're trying to de-loft the club by leaning the shaft forward. And when you lean the shaft forward, you start bringing the leading edge into the ground and digging the club into the ground. And that's when we start getting chunks.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get the club to slide along the ground using the trailing edge, more of the bounce of the club rather than the leading edge, you have what I call a wider, more forgiving bottom of the swing. So you don't have to be perfect. As far as I'm concerned, I don't want your focus being on trying to make good contact. I want your focus on how far the hole is. So understanding that if you have a more forgiving, wider bottom of the golf swing, so you don't have to be perfect, you have that margin of error built in, then you can actually focus more of your time on how far to hit the ball. It amazes me how many people make their chipping practice strokes looking straight down and their putting practice strokes looking straight down at the ground, and they have no concept about how far away the hole is. Butch Harmon once said that great players glare at the hole and glance at the ball, and weekend players glare at the ball and glance at the hole. And I think there's some wisdom there, and he's obviously had some success.
Yeah,
the players
obviously
he's coached out there. So, yeah.
Wow, that's so good. Yeah, that part of your clinic was amazing, and I can't wait to listen to it over and over and over again. The beauty of podcasts. All right, let's do a quick one on pitching. You're either the best advice you've ever received, or a secret you've figured out, or one of your tricks for pitching.
Pitching, I think the best thing to understand, it, again, has to do with the bounce and also where the bottom of the golf swing is. So if you swing a club like a pendulum, just kind of hold it between two fingers and let the club swing back and through, you'll realize that the lowest point that the club's at is always directly underneath the top end of the pendulum or the butt end of the club. So understanding where your low point is absolutely essential for being a good pitcher. If I'm pitching off of fairway grass, I actually want the low point of my swing to be just behind the ball and have the club start sliding along the ground there. And that way I have access to the bottom of the ball, which makes the ball come out higher and land softer, which is the idea of a pitch. Sometimes we use the word pitch and chipping. We don't really define them very well. So for the sake of our conversation, just call a pitch a high soft shot and a chip a low running shot. So for a high soft shot, you're going to want to use the loft of your club, and you want to make sure that the bottom of the swing is slightly behind the ball, so then the club can skim the ground underneath the ball and the ball will come up in the air that way. When you pitch, oftentimes you'll have to pitch out of rough. When you pitch out of rough, you actually want to have a little bit more of a downward strike on the golf ball. And the way you can create a downward strike is by having the handle more forward at address, or what we call a bit of a forward press, or moving the ball back a little bit of where the top end of the club is, then the club will be descending and get you under the ball that way. Which is, by the way, a great way to hit bunker shots as well. As you, if you listen to the podcast on the clinic, you'll see that I talked about where to put the handle in the bunker, which is forward. And if you have a buried lie in the bunker, you got to get it even more forward, because we want to dig even more. What I see with too many amateurs is they have a forward press in their pitching, and then they try to add loft by moving the handle backwards during the swing, or what, you know, we call a scoop, and then they end up sculling the ball.
Yep.
So I also think that a great way to learn how to pitch is to just use your trail hand. So if you're a right-handed player, just pitch with your right hand, take your left hand completely off the club, and just learn how to get the club more in line with your trail arm at impact. That will maintain loft, maintain bounce on the club, and get the club sliding along the ground rather than digging. And then again, you have your more forgiving bottom of your swing, and then you can spend more of your attention thinking about how far am I supposed to hit this thing.
You know, it was so interesting because of how verbal you are, because you were a Stanford student, and how articulate you are, I was concerned when I was recording that clinic that it's going to be hard to understand what you're doing because we're not watching it. but it is so clear what you were explaining that it works really well on audio only. So that's why I'm excited about sharing your clinic, and I appreciate you allowing me to share the clinic on the show.
Sure.
It's really exciting. And if those two tips alone on the chipping and pitching that he just provided were any indication of the kind of information that Josh can provide, then you definitely got to listen next week, because we also went, which we're not going to do now, is you went into the bunkers and talked about getting out of the bunker, whether you're on a, like an uphill lie or all the way in the back of the green or needing distance. And then you went and talked on the driving range about shorter shots, in between distance short shots, which are always so difficult for everybody. Like, they want to get as close to the hole as possible. And then when they aren't, they're like, I don't know how to get a 35-yard shot, right? As opposed to positioning yourself to what I try to do, like especially on a par five on that third shot, is where am I most comfortable? Which is the club I'm most comfortable with to get me close to the pin on that third shot? So I don't need to be as close as possible to green. I need to be in a position strategically where I can get myself in position for a birdie. Which doesn't happen when I putt.
if you look at statistics, this sounds overly logical, but the closer you are to the hole, the better you're going to score. So a lot of people say, well, you got to lay back to 100 yards. Well, sometimes you do if you need to get more spin on the ball. Again, getting a lofted club with more speed on it can stop a ball quicker. But basically, the closer you are to the hole, the easier it is to get it down in fewer shots. So the whole idea of laying back to a comfortable yardage is a little bit of an oversimplification. The numbers show differently. So that might be one of those misconceptions that people think about. Oh, by the way, it's really hard to lay back to a certain yardage. Mm-hmm. If you're good enough from 280 yards to hit it exactly 180 to get to 100 yards, more power to you. You should then you must have the talent to be able to hit it from 60 yards instead of 80 or 60 yards instead of 100. So take out that 3-wood and get closer to the green.
Mm-hmm.
Certain situations, obviously, strategically, if there's a long fairway bunker or water hazard, obviously you don't want to take a club that's going to reach those things. But in general, get the ball closer to the green in two on those par fives and use, so you have a shorter shot in.
Wow.
That's just kind of how it works. Get it closer.
Awesome. Phenomenal. Thank you so much. How can people get in touch with you or find you online to learn more about your teaching, your philosophies, and get lessons?
Xandergolf, ZanderGolf.com is my website. You can book lessons online there. You can also see, I've got probably 100 videos or more on YouTube. Got about 4 million views, so people all over the world are enjoying those videos, and they're out there for free. So if you're looking for more information on just the technique or something, you don't want to come in for a lesson, just get some information, you can look at that.
Is your YouTube channel Xander Golf?
I think it's Xander Golf, or just look under Josh Xander, you'll find them.
Okay.
They're there. I can't remember the exact thing. I should probably be better about that than I am, but
caught you off guard, didn't I?
ZanderGolf.com. You'll find everything you need on ZanderGolf.com. You'll be able to get in touch with me, phone number, email, all that kind of stuff. So
and learn a lot.
And I enjoy teaching anybody who's got an open mind and a good attitude.
Oh boy, we can do a whole 30 minutes on that alone. Josh, thanks so much for your time, and again for allowing me to record your clinic and share it with everybody. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure, Fred. Thank you for doing what you do. You're helping grow the game, and that's awesome, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. That was very kind of you. Well, as you heard, I met Josh at a charity tournament a few weeks ago. He was nice enough to let me record the audio of a short game clinic that he gave that covered chipping, pitching, bunker shots, and shots inside 60 yards. Now, beyond Josh's great YouTube channel, we've got more from Josh on Golf Smarter TV. When I arrived at this event, Josh was working with a gentleman, and you'll see that's not me when you look at it. And he was talking to him about how to get his pitch shots up in the air without hitting it so fat that it doesn't fly across the green. Have you ever experienced that? Yeah, I know. We all have. Well, it's something that every amateur struggles with. It's a very short video, but so incredibly powerful that I challenge you not to go, oh, after you watch it. Trust me on this. You'll probably want to watch it a couple times because you'll need to lock in that lesson. Again, that short video is on the homepage of golfsmarter.com, or like so many other golfers around the world, you can just subscribe for free to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/golfsmarterTV. So, like our podcast, you get notified with each new video that's been published. And have you considered the offer that I've made to you about getting a free book from the authors that we featured in the last few episodes? I know when I'm listening to podcasts and that there's an offer there for something for free, I'll go, yeah, oh God, I'd love to get that book, but yeah, there probably aren't any books left. Do you feel the same way? Well, guess what? There are plenty of copies of these, including both of Scott Ford's books, Welcome to the Zone and Integral Consciousness and Sport. And then from episode 605, two episodes ago, the informative book by Jonathan Taylor and Tim Davis, Selling on the Green. Listen to both of those episodes if you haven't yet, and then let me know that you want to get a copy of those books. And here's all you have to do to get one delivered to your front door. Be an ambassador and let others know what you think of Golf Smarter. Honestly, let them know what you think of Golf Smarter by writing a podcast review from wherever you subscribe to this show, whether you comment on me, the podcast in general, or if you'd like to be specific, then write a review about this episode or any episode that has stood out to you. Just let other podcast listeners who are interested in becoming better golfers know why they should check out Golf Smarter. Once you post the review, let me know by clicking on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com. You can post your comments on Twitter or Facebook at golfsmarter, or probably hashtag golfsmarter, and simply send an email, or the third choice, just simply send an email to fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com. Just when you do, when you write to me, include your name, your mailing address, and a copy of what you wrote and where you wrote it. And then I'll go and look at it. And once we've got that confirmed, I'm happy to send you the book. Any one of them, or all three of them, it's up to you. And all you have to do is cover the shipping and handling, which I bet all three books are going to be under $10. And I know that one book is less than $5 in the continental United States. It's really that simple. Write a review for Golf Smarter Podcast, get a book, or two, or three. Now, let's spend a minute to talk one more time about mybookie.ag, the world's leading online sports betting and gambling website that has succeeded through the fundamental three R's: reliability, reputation, and real fast payouts. MyBookie is the safest place to play that hooks you up for all your betting needs. Now's the absolute best time of the year to start your account with MyBookie.ag because there's so much great sports to choose from. The baseball playoffs are coming to an end. The NBA and hockey seasons have just begun. And both college and pro football races are getting clearer. So you know what you need to do. Go ahead and lay down some cash to win big today. You know, you do realize that where you bet is just as important as who you're betting on, because when you win, you want to get paid back. And that's what happens here. MyBookie has in-game live betting and a mobile site that makes wagering on the go easier than ever. Join MyBookie now at mybookie.ag, and they'll match your deposit with a 100% bonus. All you need to do is use the promo code GOLFSMARTER to activate this incredible offer. MyBookie.ag with the promo code GOLFSMARTER, one word, MyBookie.ag, promo code GOLFSMARTER. Now, back to Josh Sander for a minute. Up next, we'll get to hear Josh's entire short game clinic covering chipping, pitching, bunkers, and inside 60 yards. Here's the best part of next week's episode. Josh is such a great instructor that you can absorb everything he's talking about without having to see it. I'm serious. It really works. So if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, you know the drill. Please click on the Hey Fred button on the free Golf Smarter app or at golfsmarter.com.